can't tell you.
Give it to me. Give it to me. Hey.
Hey. Welcome to It's a Thing, Season 2, Episode 8. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I am Molly Wood, and this is the show where we are totally trend spotting the hottest things that are going on in our admittedly slightly narrow little lives.
I just noticed in glancing at our little rundown here, it's our environmental special.
Oh, it kind of is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just this one show.
It's our green show.
It's a green show, a little bit. Although once you hear my thing, I think you're going to actually understand that it's more like our brown show.
mine can easily lead to a brown show. So it might be our green-brown show.
It starts green and it ends brown.
Just like so many things.
Remember when Tom's new thing was veggies? Like that. Almost exactly like that.
Actually. Yep. Almost exactly like that.
Show ever.
So should we start with green? I'll start with mine.
Please do.
That seems to make sense. That seems
Let's
to be logical.
What the hell we're talking about.
I read a Scientific American article recently about eating invasive species, which that was enough for me. I'm like, that's a thing. That's very interesting. So invasive species, in other words, a species comes from some other part of the planet, like kudzu is the most famous example,
right,
and invades and drives out the natural animals that live there. And so one of the solutions is to, you know, lionfish, for instance, very pretty, but people dump them out of their aquariums and then they invade and take over ponds, eat the lionfish. And feral pigs is another example of this. So I looked it up and there's a great article in The Atlantic about this. It's become a high dining, fine dining thing to serve invasive species.
That's awesome.
Kind of like the organic movement was in the 70s. Now it's like, we only serve snakeheads from invasive snakes.
I love that, though, because that's that's kind of as awesome as locally sourced or whatever.
Oh, it's like the next extreme from locally sourced.
It takes the smugness up an almost exponential notch. Like,
right. So the snakeheads, I'm not kidding. Snakeheads are filleted with Old Bay, salt and pepper, and then grilled right on the boat.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Excellent table fare.
Now, I also found in casting about, from the boat, get it? This article in Florida about be careful about eating invasive species because they need to be prepared properly. You should only eat them from somebody who knows how to properly prepare them or has learned how to properly prepare, or you yourself should learn how to properly prepare them because they can be toxic.
Wait, all invasive species can be?
Well, many of them can because these are feral, right? These are wild animals. They're not farmed, so they're not under controlled conditions. They're not given antibiotics, even though everybody's like, oh, I don't want any antibiotics. You definitely don't want to catch something from the food you're eating. So for instance, snails, there's these giant African land snails that came from Nigeria. They invaded in Miami, and Margaret Lanier at Sherry Restaurant used to serve them until they became too costly and then started finding them in South Florida and started serving them again. But you have to be careful because when they're raised in captivity, they're fed a diet of lettuce and chicken feed and commercial snail food, and that's fine. But when they're out in the wild, they're crawling through dirt and picking up bacteria and eating things that might not be bad for the snail, but might be bad for you.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to
donate them raw.
So yeah, what they're saying is you got to harvest the invasive snails and then feed them lettuce for a couple of weeks to purge out whatever's in them, and then you can eat them.
What? All right, that seems kind of crazy. I mean, I guess that makes sense. Sort of.
Well, and that's just for snails, but
it makes sense though because there's like a lot of bad things in the ground that didn't used to be in the ground in the old days. You know that. Totally makes sense.
Exactly.
It is fascinating though. Now I'm looking at this article in The Atlantic and there's all kinds of things like the feral pigs, but there's also like something called bastard cabbage, periwinkle fritters and garlic mustard. There's some green crabs that are invasive species.
Yeah, some of these are some of these aren't even like, oh, that's weird. I don't know if I want to eat a snail or a lionfish. Some of it's like popcorn sparrow, deep fried Cajun bullfrog.
Right.
These are all things that...
Well, those are a little weird.
Well, sparrow's a little weird.
But crabs and cabbage is not weird. And anything.
What does
porky,
it say about me that I'm like, sparrow and bullfrogs, those aren't the weird ones.
That you're an Anglophile, you weirdo. What do you think about the highly invasive
frogs,
grape?
Though, that's Frenchy, man. That's
true. That's true.
That's weird.
Apparently, though, in England, the highly invasive gray squirrel has become such a popular protein that they're having a hard time keeping them on the menu.
Just eat the squirrel.
And they have sparked a revival in the Victorian delicacy squirrel pie.
Squirrel pie is back?
Squirrel pie is back.
You heard it here first, folks.
It's, a sub thing.
This is anyway, you got to read this
Atlantic article. I love this thing. What a good thing.
Crabs are a good one.
But seriously, you've spotted a really fascinating thing.
It is. And yes, you should be careful and it should be prepared well. And maybe it really won't have a large enough effect because some people are not criticizing it, but they're saying, well, this isn't really going to solve the invasive species problem because not enough people are adventurous enough eaters to eat enough of them, but it can't hurt.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And in most cases, you probably don't have to be that. You just have to cook it as much as you would cook any other food.
Yeah. And if you are worried about sustainability and you are worried about, am I eating, you know, over-farmed, over-fished fish? Am I eating some kind of maltreated cow or chicken? If you're eating invasive species, you know I'm eating animals that deserved it.
See? Smugness.
They had it coming. Coming into our country, stealing our animals' jobs.
That's right.
I will eat you.
That is outstanding. They deserved it. Love it. All right. Well, this is this is a good time to reassure our audience, by the way, that in keeping with our super loosey-goosey style here on the show, we do not talk about these things before we talk about the show. We just kind of plop them into a spreadsheet, and then we have things. So the fact that these are so weirdly related is not our fault. But the thing that I have noticed...
It's extraordinarily well-planned and amazing. Look
right.
At us.
Or that. You decide. So the thing that I have spotted as an increasingly interesting conversational thing is the microbiome. Mm. And this whole conversation about the microbiome, which is basically the collection of bacteria and fungi, viruses, and other microbes that live all over our bodies. And that scientists are starting to look at the microbiome, which is this entire collection all in one, as sort of as for one thing, like a super necessary element in our own health, and almost like its own little living organism that dictates how our bodies are going to behave. And they're getting this really broad idea of what microbes do. Like, for example, we've known for a long time, notes NPR, that we depend on bacteria to digest our food. But they consider it almost like an 11th organ system now.
Isn't there something where there's like more cells from other organisms than there are actual cells of your body?
Yes,
in you?
Exactly. Yeah. Like, that's what they notice about bacteria specifically. So they don't know... that people are starting to be able to figure out what's wrong with the microbiome. They're starting to wonder if problems with the microbiome could be related to diabetes, celiac,
right,
and even autism. You know, it's part of the conversation about why are autism rates skyrocketing? Could it be because our bodies don't have the right balance of bacteria and fungus and viruses? And could it, you know, be that the environment, you know, we're all looking for an environmental cause, and maybe the environmental cause is basically this collection of yucky stuff, otherwise yucky stuff, inside our own bodies. Like, they're even – this is where it gets a little brown.
Transplants.
Doctors have started performing microbe transplants in order to cure people with life-threatening infections. They're doing fecal transplants.
Ah, you said it.
Yep. To cure them with the bacterium Clostridium difficile. They replaced the patient's ailing gut bacteria with new colonies donated by a healthy person.
I actually read about this in Scientific American as well, and they say that one of the problems they're getting in scientific consensus around the transplant issue in particular is just the ooh factor.
Yeah.
You know, because I had that visceral reaction when you said it. I'm sure everyone in the audience did too. But yeah, I had a gut reaction. And we're talking about a very tiny amount encapsulated in a very clean gel cap or something. I don't know exactly how they do it, but we're not talking about what we all unfortunately probably pictured.
Yeah, no, it's not. They're not putting
very medical. Yeah,
not like a pile of poo.
Right.
But it is definitely the bacteria that comes from that material. I mean, it's fascinating, right? It's super new research. Nobody's exactly willing to put all kinds of theories out there and say this is definitely what's happening. But it just goes along with this whole interesting conversation about how we've been saying for the 100 years or whatever that you are what you eat. And now scientists are starting to say, like, maybe you really are what you eat. Like, you even have psychologists looking, or psychiatrists looking at whether gluten could be a factor in behavioral disorders. Because yeah. Because the microbiome seems to be so powerful in terms of its impact on our bodies.
Well, and I think one of the things I would like to shine a big bright light on is that if this is true, well, it is true. We have a very complex microbiome, mm-hmm. and what we eat affects it, and how it reacts affects how we feel and how we work. Keep that in mind before you make the same mistake and go, and therefore the microbiome is the cure for everything. It's complex.
Yeah.
This probably has an effect on all of those things we're talking about because it is so much a part of us, but it's probably not the only cause. It's an influence, and we got to tease apart how all this different stuff works, because I also just read about obesity. They're finally getting back to a pre-1950s approach to say, wait a minute, maybe this is the reward circuit in some people being faulty. Not that they're crazy or mentally ill, mm-hmm. but that once you start eating, it's similar to drug addiction, not the same, in that you just can't stop.
Yep.
Right? It just activates that reward circuit naturally because you want food to keep you alive. And in some people, the satiation just doesn't kick in. And it gets overridden. And I can totally see how that could still be true, and yet the microbiome also be like, and we just happen to have a microbiome that makes it really efficient so that every one of those things you're overeating just gets stored away right away, you know, and other people don't. They've got a microbiome that breaks it down and passes it through and doesn't get stored at all. So it could be the same reward system malfunction, but the microbiome totally changes how that person reacts to it.
Right. Which makes so much sense. It's funny because at the end of the day, it all seems to point to the fact that we are not all the same and that everybody's different and people respond to things in different ways. But we will undoubtedly, as a species and a scientific community and a whatever, totally overreact to this.
Yes.
In a way that suggests that if we just apply this one solution to everybody, that it will definitely work. And as much as I your caution is so wonderful, and so true, and so important, and will not be heeded at all, because for the next 2 years we are going to be talking about the microbiome and how it is the be all end all of science.
I only eat prebiotics of invasive species.
Yeah, I'm starting an artisanal prebiotic.
Prebiotic lionfish
prebiotic
colony.
Lionfish colony. Wow, dude. Artisanal prebiotic lionfish colony is my new band name.
Yeah, I don't even know what cover band that could. That's its own band. They're not covering anything.
Mm-mm, no. Wow. This is a fascinating. This is a really interesting show, in my opinion.
I'll write that one down, too. Prebiotic lionfish. Artisanal prebiotic lionfish. Yeah.
Colony.
No. Yeah. So if you eat the right snails, that can actually help your microbiome.
There you go.
It's the other lesson here.
All kinds of things can help your microbiome.
That's fascinating. Yeah, because
I love it.
I definitely have changed my microbiome many times over mm-hmm. the years because you change your diet.
Yeah. Well, and you know, and there's this powerful argument to be made that the environment is changing our microbiome.
Yep.
That some of this is, you know, goes to the entire conversation of like, right, of course it is changing our microbiome. And part of what's changing it is that we antibacterial the hell out of ourselves.
Yeah.
And that's not good for us.
Allergies, a lot of these things could be a lack of being exposed to dirt and bacteria at mm-hmm. an early age because you just never build up the microbiome to deal with it.
Yep, exactly. Also, cesareans.
How does that work?
So when you're born,
uh-huh.
you emerge covered in this meconium stuff, uh-huh. which is basically super yucky tar-like fecal matter.
Right.
But that you, as an infant, ingest a lot of that, and it really helps. It is crucial.
It's like a dosage.
It's like a dosage that helps to build your microbiome right off the bat. And if you are born from a relatively sterile C-section and God knows this is not me trying to cast aspersions, because there are emergency C-sections that save lives, period. And that is super important. And I'm glad it exists. However, like, it's an interesting area of research because it could say to people, okay, you didn't come out covered in meconium, so we have to do like a little fecal transplant on your infant, you know, something.
Just gotta dunk you in some meconium, that's all.
Or give him an anti, it's like a vitamin, but but it's poop.
Poop vitamins.
It's like a vitamin, but it's poop.
Vita Brown. Available now.
Vita Brown.
Well, I think it's time for something more mundane.
I think so, too. Let's take a break from the poop, shall we?
Yeah, finally. shall I start with my new thing?
Yes.
It's the Logitech Harmony Ultimate Universal Remote. And I'll be honest. I only started using it as a review item for Twit. And I have an old Logitech Harmony 800 from way back in the ancient times of 2007. And the buttons were starting to wear out. And those Logitech Harmonies, they're always hard to actually program in the first place. Once you get them programmed, they're pretty handy. So I was like, I guess I'll try the new one. It's the same thing. It's just going to be a little fancier. That thing's amazing.
What?
It's incredible. It, like, so changed the way that I approach my television watching now. Because, first of all, the buttons work, and my old buttons broke. So part of that's just a personal thing. But it's got a little touchscreen, and it matches up with all of the buttons so much better because they're not trying to predict what buttons the remote it's mimicking are supposed to be. It can reconfigure naturally. So it works a lot better. You can pre-program favorite channels with their little icon. So when you want to switch to home and garden television, you just look for the icon. You go, oh, HGTV, boom, tap it. And it works with RF.
Oh.
So you don't have to point the remote at anything.
That is huge because my complaint about the Logitech Harmony remotes, even as far back as pre-Logitech when they were just Harmony, is that the damn things never turned everything on.
You had to sit there and hold. I had to tell people when they visited, now, this, you just press watch TV, but don't press it and pull the remote away. You have to press it and sit there and wait.
Yeah. Count so to like four and wait for everything to come on, and still one component is not going to come on.
I just added a line of sight. No, that's all gone now.
I can't believe it.
Yeah.
All these years later, nigh on a decade after its introduction, the Harmony remote finally friggin' works.
So I'm honestly, because I went through the pain, and the downside is setting them up online is awful. It's a mess. They need to fix that. But once you get it done, you don't have to do it again until you buy a new thing. And I kind of just want to buy one of these and send the one I buy back to them as the review unit.
Be like, here's the new one because I already have this one.
Because I have this one programmed just right.
That seems like a fair trade.
Yeah.
I would suggest that because I am amazed to hear that they have not fixed that setup thing because it's always been a nightmare. And it's so funny because they always say in this weird bit of like disturbing disingenuousness that it's so easy to do the web programming.
It's easy once it's done.
Yeah. But they tout the web programming as part of what makes it easy, and it's just like anyone who's ever done it can tell you that's not true.
Well, they do it in Silverlight. But anyway, this isn't a tech show, but
I am delighted to hear that it finally works because it's true that the right remote. I'll tell you though, I recently went back to TiVo, and I couldn't have been happier to get back to that TiVo remote.
Yeah,
I just love it.
It's a good design remote.
Such a nice little remote. Just does what it's supposed to do. Okay, so speaking of TV, again, you guys, we did not coordinate this. It just so happened to be perfect. My new thing is a TV show. And it is not one of those TV shows that everyone's watching, that everyone knows. Well, I think like a lot of people are now watching.
Dynasty or...
It's not The Wire, and it's not Breaking Bad, and it's not the
Homeland.
Zombie thing. It's not Homeland.
The zombie thing. Walking Dead?
Walking Dead. Whatever, I repressed it because it's too scary. My new TV show is Drunk History.
I have seen the ads for that. I've never watched it.
Oh, dude. You, personally, you, Tom Merritt, are the person who should be watching this show.
Because I like to be drunk and I like history.
Yes. And it is really historical. Like, it's real history and it's wonderful. And it's city by city, like that, so that the, you know, the show goes to different cities and then they tell different stories that are relevant to that city. So like I just watched the Detroit one and they had a whole story about the Kellogg brothers and Harry Houdini.
Oh yeah, okay.
Because he died in Detroit apparently after the punch.
And the Kellogg brothers, Battle Creek, Michigan.
Yeah, exactly. And it is the funniest and best show ever. Like, I love to learn the historical lessons, and then it's just drunk people telling the stories. The people, I'm sorry to say, are getting a little bit more famous as the episodes go on. Like, it used to be that it sort of seemed like normal people are like local celebrities or local socialites who got drunk and told the stories. Now this last one had like Paget Brewster. But, you know, I'm still okay with that because they're drunk.
So,
and it's awesome. And then
what I want to know is, like, how do they say, like, we got him drunk and then asked him about history? How does that, what's the mechanic there?
Yeah. So they, okay. Well, so then the other key part before I answer that question is that the drunk people tell the stories and then they get actors to reenact the drunk telling. So they edit back and forth between the drunk person telling the story and then actors who are dressed up in period costumes who are mouthing the drunk words.
It's like written by a kid or Axe Cop or something.
Yeah. I mean, it's hysterical. Like, you know, they'll be like, in the Kellogg Brothers one, right? He'll be talking along like, no, I invented this cereal and I won the trademark on the Kellogg name. And then they go to the other Kellogg brother and he goes, I think I'm going to burp. Which is what it's not even their voices, right? It's all still narrated by the drunk person. It's hilarious. So then, yeah, I think what I think is that they must tell them the history ahead of time or like drill them in it. Mm. Or it just so happens that Paget Brewster is really well versed in the history of the Kellogg brothers, but I don't think so.
Could be.
I think she's the chosen narrator and that she could be though. That's why I liked it when it was sort of like a local famous person-ish or something, like the San Francisco lady. But either way, it's absolutely hysterical. And then I think it's starting to get really popular. It's on Comedy Central. It's a real television show, by the way. And I think it's gotten so popular that now they're getting all these amazing guest stars. Like the Kellogg brothers were played by Luke and Owen Wilson.
No way. Really?
And Alfred Molina played Sir Arthur Conan Doyle in the one about Harry Houdini in this last
episode. So you have people like, I want to be on Drunk History. Can I be on Drunk History?
They're totally just like, oh my God, I totally want to be on Drunk History.
Calling their agents, get me on Drunk History. I don't care what it takes.
And these people get unbelievably drunk. Like, there's usually some sort of...
like, how do they get the legal protection to do that?
Because they come to their house. Like, this host is always there, and he comes to their house, and they all get drunk.
Yeah.
Like, host Derek Waters is just like, here, I showed up with scotch, and they must sign a thing that says...
there's got to be a big old waiver for that, yeah.
Super long, because they always are on the verge of alcohol poisoning. Like, somebody almost always throws up in every episode.
And they're responsible, like, Molly.
And then you'll see, oh my God, no. The CNET TV executive producer told me that she watches it with her 10-year-old son. She's like, I think it's a bad thing. I can't help it because it's so funny and there's history in it.
Hey, whatever gets them watching history. Maybe it will teach children the dangers of drinking.
Maybe. Like
it teaches them history. If you overdo it, kids, this is what's going to happen to you.
I don't know.
Drink responsibly.
No, they're so funny. The San Francisco one starred Kristen Wiig as Patty Hearst. No.
Is Patty Hearst?
It's Patty Hearst.
That's almost perfect. Actually.
You got it. Like, you got to watch it. It's just absolutely amazing. Amazing. Yeah. It's totally my new thing. I love it so much, so much.
Well, I hope that your thing, it's your thing, the one we pull from the audience, can measure up to that. And I think it can. Watermelon Babies of China.
Yeah, what?
This is from Harold. Not all parents in China are dressing their kids in melon wear, and there isn't an army of watermelon children roaming the street. However, this does seem to be a thing.
Yeah, I am just... And then he sent us a link to... Apparently, NPR is just stealing Moment of Zen.
Yeah, could they do that? Is that all right?
I don't think so. But there's a whole melon children meme. Like this, I think it started maybe with one kid. Yeah, so it started with one little kid who was dressed up in watermelon overalls. Like he had half a watermelon on his head and then half a watermelon on his bottom with the suspenders. And then now there are photos of all these little online imitators and people are like cutting the watermelon into little like loincloths and helmets. It's amazing. It's amazing.
I'm awestruck at the watermelon samurai.
Yeah, the watermelon samurai. I mean, that's some creative watermelon cutting.
Because it's not just the samurai helmet and the samurai sword, but he's also got the samurai girdle, whatever, you know, little diaper.
Yeah, exactly. The watermelon
diaper.
I called it a loincloth, but yeah, it's more like a girdle, I guess.
Yeah, or something. Loincloth's a more samurai-like name. I think you're right.
I don't know, but it's freaking awesome.
There's been a record-setting summer heat wave in China, writes Maria Godoy, who I swear, I think that's the Maria Godoy I worked with at Tech TV. But anyway.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Probably. She says that kind of kicked it off. Like, yeah, you need to cool off. What better way to cool off your baby than to dress him in watermelon?
What?
That's not what she wrote. I made that part.
I know, but that's still, yeah. They'll love it. I'm just amazing.
Well, thank you, Harold.
One of my favorite comment of all, especially seeing the kid in the watermelon samurai helmet, is it just me or is anyone else impressed by the strength of those watermelon babies' necks?
Hold up some. I mean, watermelon rinds are not light.
Mm-mm. No. Wow.
Lest
I love
we
it.
Forget. Well, Harold, I think this was off the blog too, not off Twitter. So I think that might be a first. I'm not sure.
Ooh, that's a big one.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's awesome.
And keep them coming.
Please do. That blog's address is itsathing.me. Itsathing.me if you would like to find the episodes and make comments. We get lots of people in there commenting and telling us things. It's awesome.
Yeah, please do. And yeah, tweet us, put it on the blog. We'd love it. I love how enthusiastic everybody has been about sending us things, because I think it's a natural tendency to look around and be like, what is everyone doing?
What sparks your, all of a sudden you notice like, wait a minute, that's a thing.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it until now. So
I know. I think it's a thing for everybody to be really into finding things.
Keep the tweets coming.
Yep. Tweet us. See you next week. Bye. I don't need no man speaking lies.